So many of you know that I just got back this morning from a youth retreat. There are 20 of us, and we went and we stayed at a church in Hayward this weekend, several of our teenage boys, ours and the boys from the other churches, decided that it was like their goal to keep me up as late as they could on Friday night, and so I plan to get them back today. We get to this church, and I go in and I drop my stuff off in the guys' room, and then the guys drop their stuff off in the guys' room, and the girls drop their stuff off in the girls' room, and we finish unloading food stuff and our games, and we had been there maybe 15 minutes, 20 minutes tops, when I walk back into the guys' room to get something out of my bag, and I am thrown back by how badly the room already smells. It smells like teenage boy, which is this crazy combination of boy, sweat, and Axe body spray. In the first 20 minutes, I literally slept outside in the hall, a bright hallway. The lights didn't go out just to get away from the smell. So we wake up this morning, and we're getting packed up, and one of the drivers from another church shows up and gets there to help pick up some of their students. And she walks into the hallway, and she looks like she's going to pass out. She's reeling and gagging, and she's like, "How can you stand this?" And I look at her, and I said, "It still smells." And in that moment, I realized I had now been in it so long that I stopped noticing it. And in the moment that I realized I had stopped noticing it, there were no showers at this place, at this church that we stayed at. And so I realized that that after 36 hours on this retreat, not only was I covered in the smell, but I had now begun to contribute to it. Believe it or not, this is James's concern in the letter that he is writing to the churches all over the world. These churches are filled with brand new followers of Jesus, but these young followers of Jesus are covered in the world. And they have been in the world for so long that they can't even see how much of the world is on them. They can't see that their wisdom doesn't come from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, and demonic. They're covered in jealousy and in selfish ambition, and this earthly wisdom is creating disorder in the churches, and it results in every vile practice. They need to be cleansed. This is why James says that first of all, the wisdom from above is pure. Thanks to this driver who showed up and named what I could no longer smell, I got home this morning, and although I was tempted to burn all of my things, I settled for the wash, and I showered, and then I showered again. James is naming what we cannot smell in our lives. He's naming what we cannot see. And for James, we have been in the wisdom of the world for so long that we don't even know what the wisdom from above would look like if we saw it. And so he takes us one by one through each of these characteristics, and we've spent each week looking at each of these different features of the wisdom from above. Pure. Peaceable. Gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruit, impartial. But we've done more, right, than just notice each of these characteristics along the way. We've been learning what they look like, what they smell like. And we've been discovering that these qualities are gifts that can only come from God. And so we've been praying week after week in this time, in this space, breaking up in smaller groups, praying for each other that God would help us to be wise in each of these ways. We've been asking, God, would you help us to be pure, resisting friendship with the world? Would you help us to be peacemakers who work for peace among enemies? Jesus, would you help us to be gentle like you, not forcing ourselves on others or our faith on other people? Would you help us to be open to reason so that we can always be persuaded by the truth of your cross? Jesus, would you help us to be full of mercy and good fruits so that through us, people experience your kindness and are eager to turn to you? Help us, Lord, to be impartial, refusing to create distinctions among us or live by the distinctions of our culture. Which brings us to this week. You may have noticed that in our reading earlier, we heard the word genuine in this final spot. The ESV translates this word sincere. Both of these are kind of weird and actually frustrating translations. There are several other translations that I think are a bit clearer. The word that shows up here, this last word in this passage, is the same word that shows up throughout all of the Gospels and in a number of the letters in the New Testament every single time as hypocrite. The only difference is that in this place, there is an A in the front of the word, which immediately makes the word the opposite. So it's the opposite of a hypocrite. It's a non-hypocrite, or as the NASB, the NRSV translations say, without hypocrisy is this last category. The wisdom from above is without hypocrisy. It's not hypocritical. I don't know about you, but I find it really hard to talk about hypocrisy just in the church today. Not because like there are more hypocrites in the church today than at some time in the past. We have often been hypocrites at various times and various moments, sometimes shifting in and out of it. But there are, I think, two kind of forces at work in the church that make it really hard for us to talk about hypocrisy. And the first is that we know how the world views the church in this time and in this place. More and more people outside the church report that it is the hypocrisy of Christians that keeps them from the church, that keeps them from seeking Jesus. Which means, in many ways, we've come to recognize hypocrisy sort of feels like one of the chief sins in our day. To some extent, there are very few things that are worse than being called a hypocrite. At least that's how we sort of feel. Which means that, like, hypocrisy, talking about hypocrisy can be really dangerous because, like, nobody wants to admit that they might be a hypocrite, and nobody wants to be accused of being a hypocrite. And so, right, you can see how sort of difficult it can be to talk about it, to consider it, to even see it in ourselves, to recognize when we carry the smell. But then there's a second force at work making it hard to talk about hypocrisy, and that is that there is actually a popular definition of hypocrisy that is different from the definition of hypocrisy that we find in the Bible. So that these aren't the same thing. And so, like, if you can imagine, if there are these two different definitions that work, a popular definition and a biblical definition, we could spend a lot of time and energy trying not to be hypocrites according to the sort of world definition, the common popular definition. But because we define hypocrisy differently than the Bible, often our attempts to not be hypocrites can result in hypocritical behavior. Like, this is kind of how it works. Most people know or have heard at some point, or maybe familiar with the fact that the word hypocrite comes from the world of ancient theater. So a hypocrite was an actor who commonly wore a mask on the stage. And so what we've done with that word is that we have sort of imagined that hypocrisy, if it refers to an actor who wears a mask, then what a hypocrisy is the difference between the inner true self, the self behind the mask, my feelings, my motivations, and the outer face that's put on, or the front, or the mask. And so what this does is it makes our main concern a concern for authenticity. We want to be real. We want to be the same person on the inside as the outside. We want our outside actions to reflect our inner feelings. We don't want to be hypocrites who hide our true feelings. We don't want to be fake or dishonest. And so this means that Christians in our day are sometimes willing to disobey Jesus's teachings, his instructions, because Christians sometimes don't feel like following them. And if hypocrisy is the chief sin of our day, then to do something that doesn't feel right is a worse sin than disobedience. Because if you do something that you don't feel or that you don't really mean, then you're being fake or dishonest or inauthentic or a hypocrite. I've heard parents of children say before, or teenagers, it's been a while, but this used to be somewhat common, that they wouldn't make their kids go to church or read their Bibles because they don't want to train their kids how to become hypocrites, because they want their kids to want to go to church. They want their kids to want to read the Bible. And these parents think that they'd be turning their kid into a hypocrite by doing something that they don't feel or want to do in some given moment. Do you recognize this kind of way of talking about hypocrisy? Sometimes we hear it in the way that we talk about worship. Like, I don't want to sing the words unless I really feel them. I don't want to raise my hands or be demonstrative in some way unless I'm really moved to. And so in this way, the way we define hypocrisy, singing words that I don't feel is being fake. Even if I am declaring true words about who God is, and I'm actually saying right now, regardless of how I feel, this is the truth. Praising God when you don't feel like it can feel dishonest or inauthentic. This way of defining hypocrisy shows up in our Bible translations, where we get words like genuine or sincere that carry this sort of meaning. But when we look at Jesus, the one who talks the most about hypocrisy in the New Testament, he just doesn't talk about hypocrisy in this way, not even once. In fact, this is kind of the crazy thing. When the world accuses Christians of being hypocritical, those outside of the church are often using the word hypocrite in a way that's more consistent with Jesus and the Bible than the way that sometimes we use the language in the faith and the family of God. When those outside of the church call Christians hypocrites, it's generally not because Christians are acting inauthentic to their emotions or being fake about their feelings. People outside of the church call Christians hypocrites because Christians make unnecessarily public shows of their faith, or because they can see the gap between what Christians say and what they do. And as we turn to Jesus, we discover that these are the very things that Jesus called hypocrisy. A few minutes ago, we read a section from the Sermon on the Mount. Thanks, Andrew. And this week, if you had the daily worship guide, throughout the week, you were reading from Matthew 23. Between these two teachings, we get these two broad definitions for hypocrisy. In both cases, you can see how the image of the ancient actor putting on a mask is at work. So listen to what Jesus has to say in the Sermon on the Mount. If you have your Bibles, Matthew chapter 5 or chapter 6, we'll sort of re-look at some of the highlights. It was cracking me up. Andrew, while you were reading, Becca had like a paper transcript of what you were reading. She was just marking with a pen, and I lean over and I'm like, what are you highlighting? She's like, all the important stuff. It was all highlighted. I was like, yeah, that's... Yeah, there were like four words that weren't. Jesus didn't mean those words. Just kidding. Matthew chapter 6, verse 1. We hear, beware of practicing your righteousness before other people in order to be seen by them. Look at verse 2. When you give to the needy, sound no trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may be praised by others. Verse 5, when you pray, you must not be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and at the street corners, that they may be seen by others. Verse 7, when you pray, do not heap up empty phrases that the Gentiles do, for they think that they will be heard for their many words. Verse 16, when you fast, do not look gloomy like the hypocrites, for they disfigure their faces, that their fasting may be seen by others. I mean, you hear the point, right? The hypocrites are not guilty of wearing a mask, but of making a public show of their faith. The hypocrite isn't criticized, actually, for wearing a mask. We often focus on the mask that a hypocrite wears. Jesus isn't criticizing the hypocrite for wearing a mask. He's just sort of taking the whole as a thing. The hypocrite's criticized for going on the stage at all in order to be seen, to be praised by others, to be seen by others so that others might hear. And you notice what Jesus doesn't say. He doesn't say, now practice your righteousness unless you really... He doesn't say don't practice your righteousness unless you really feel it. And he doesn't say don't give unless you really have the right motivation. And he doesn't tell us to stop praying or fasting. No, like the assumption is that we will keep doing all of these things whether we feel like it or not. We just won't make a show of it. And so here's the question, a first question for us to consider. And so if you're taking notes, you might write this down because we're going to come back to it later. But what does it look like to make a show of faith in our day? What does it look like to make a show of our faith in our own day, in this time, in this place? Take a second to consider that. What does it look like to make a show of our faith in our own day? Okay, so that's the first definition of hypocrisy. So what about the second one? For that, we turn to Matthew 23. Jesus turns toward the religious leaders of his day, and he begins to criticize them for their hypocrisy. And his opening line tells us everything that we need to know. The rest of the speech is basically just examples. And so he says this in verse 2. The scribes and the Pharisees who sit on Moses' seat practice and observe whatever they tell you, but not what they do. For they preach, but they do not practice. You've heard the saying, right? Practice what you preach. This is it. This is where it comes from. And it's the classic do what I say, not what I do line that parents and coaches and teachers are sort of known for, have a reputation for. For Jesus, this is the very heart of hypocrisy. It's not to feel one thing inside and do another. It is to say one thing and do another. It is to confess Jesus as Lord and then not obey him, not follow him. To be a hypocrite is to know the answers, to know what to do, to tell others what to do, but then to not do it. In verse 23, we actually find one of the most explicit examples of this. where he says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. These you ought to have done without neglecting the others. You blind guides, straining out a gnat and swallowing a camel." Okay, so what's going on here? The scribes and the Pharisees are teachers and they're authorities of the law. And they know that in the law, God commands his people to tithe off of whatever they produce from the earth. The law assumes that most people will be farming land. And so people are told that they are to give some amount of the crop to the priests, who will then distribute it so that the priests who aren't allowed to own land will have something to survive on, and the poor and widows and orphans and aliens who don't have their own land will all have enough to eat. So the teachers of the law, they know this. If you're unfamiliar with the word tithe, it literally just means a tenth. And so God is commanding his people to give a tenth of their land's produce for the sake of others. But this isn't because God's a bully and he's trying to steal from those who have worked hard. God tells us why he does this. The people were to do it so that there could be justice, so that they could do justice, so that they could show mercy, and that they could be faithful to God and to God's people. The law was about these things: justice, mercy, and faithfulness. James has summed up these three even under one category in the book of James. The law of God is about love your neighbor as yourself. Justice, mercy, and faithfulness is all there. But Jesus criticizes the religious leaders who are following the law by giving a tenth of their mint, dill, and cumin. But why? Why would he criticize them? They're obeying the law. They're doing what God apparently wants them to do, right? Well, no, they stand up and they teach that God's people are supposed to do justice, that they're supposed to offer mercy, that they're supposed to live faithfully, but they themselves are not. See, mint and dill and cumin, these would have been like small little amounts of produce from like small little home gardens that they had. And so here's what they're like able to do. These are small amounts that they're giving that allow them to feel justified in neglecting the weightier things. These religious leaders would have had other sources of income. We know that a number of them were actually fairly wealthy in this day, but that technically didn't qualify under the rules about a tithe because they weren't produce from the land. And yet there were still needs to be met. There were people around them who needed help. How do we know this? Because everywhere Jesus went, there were people who needed help, people who needed mercy, people who needed all sorts of stuff that the religious leaders of their day weren't offering. Because these religious leaders had been able to check off the tithe box. And so they felt justified, ignoring the cries of those who were in need. The image of straining out a gnat but swallowing a camel. It's kind of an awesome image, isn't it? And this is one of those places where Jesus is funny. Sometimes we take Jesus so seriously, we forget that he like was a human being and said funny stuff. And this is pretty hilarious. Because you can see the picture, right? Someone who's just obsessed, meticulously focused on making sure that their glass of water doesn't get a single gnat in it. They're so focused on straining that water to get the gnat out, this tiny bug, doing what they can to keep it out, but somehow a giant camel winds up in their drink and they swallow it. Like, it's absurd. It's supposed to like make you go, it's outrageous. Because they weren't concerned about the camel. They didn't even notice the camel because they loved that gnat. Or they hated that gnat. Really wanted to get that gnat out. But you can see probably a number of ways throughout the church's history that we have often swallowed camels whole while straining the gnat. And probably today, one of the ways that we've done this has been the way that the church as a whole has dealt with sexual ethics. The church as a whole has obsessed over a particular set of sexual behaviors, a very narrow group of people, while ignoring the camel that is marriage and singleness and human sexuality. The church has been so backwards on marriage for so long. We're talking hundreds of years. The church has had such little regard for singleness in the church, even though there are whole passages in the New Testament that celebrate singleness as a principle, honorable vocation. The church has been disconnected from God's purposes around sexuality, that we have swallowed a camel and we don't even realize it. We can no longer smell it, to mix metaphors. But we are obsessed over that gnat. Now you can hear Jesus speaking to these leaders. He says, you should tithe your mint and dill and cumin without neglecting the weightier matters. And so that's not to say that the gnat is insignificant. And so here's the second question for us to consider. What are some of the ways the church needs to practice what it preaches? This part of chapter 23 might give us one window, but chapter 23 introduces us to a number of ways that that God's people often fail to practice what we preach. And so let's take a second to just consider this. If you wrote something for the first question, maybe here you can add something else. What are some of the ways the church needs to practice what we preach? So that as we finish up, I want to remind you that not being hypocritical isn't something that we just try harder at. I've said this several times as we've worked through these characteristics of the wisdom from above, that these truly are gifts from God. God enables our obedience. God enables us to respond and to live out his instructions. And so it's not something that we just muscle, but this is something that Jesus does in us, because this is who Jesus was. And as we focus on him, as we allow him into our lives, as we allow him and his ways to permeate who we are, our thinking and our desiring and our acting, this is who we become. And we see Jesus. Jesus doesn't make a show of his faith. In everything Jesus did, who did he point to? The Father. He was always busy pointing people to his Father and not to himself. He was never making a show. And in every way, Jesus was devoted, a devoted and loving son. And so he was passionate about doing the Father's will. He didn't just stand up and say, this is the Father's will. But he showed people what the Father's will was. Jesus practiced what he preached because he preached the Father's love and he showed the Father's love. This is what Jesus' entire life was obsessed with. He was utterly devoted to this. And so what would it look like for a church? What would it look like for our church to be obsessed with sharing the Father's love, of pointing people toward the Father, constantly and consistently, not to ourselves, but to him. And what would it look like for a church to be obsessed with showing the Father's love? Living it out, being about the Father's business, listening to his instructions, and then being eager to live them out so that other people might see his kindness, his mercy, and his faithfulness. This is what Jesus is inviting us into. But we can't do it alone. Jesus has given us the gift of a family, of community. And so we're gonna do something that is gonna be familiar to some of you, to those of you who are here on a regular basis, but to those who are visiting with us, this might be a little bit strange. And so thanks for participating with us. There's gonna be an image that's gonna pop up on that screen, and it's gonna indicate where groups will break up in this space. And we're gonna spend about 15 minutes or so putting into practice what James says. He calls us to not be simply hearers of the word, but doers of the word. And so on Sundays, we are practicing being doers of the word together by wrestling with these questions, but then also just praying for each other. Because James says, if any of you lacks wisdom, pray. The Father might give generously. So here's what we're gonna do. We can help you find your group, but these are sort of geographically or region-based. And so if you live in Springtown or over the Altamont, you guys are right over there. Look, we have some, you guys sat there, you knew, that way you didn't have to move. Well done. right here in the center is Central Livermore. So like if you're near North Livermore Avenue, you know, some degree to the east or west, Central Livermore's right there. East Livermore is kind of in that back corner. And so that's like Vasco and East Avenue, kind of that whole sort of region. Pleasanton, Dublin, San Ramon is over there. Southwest Livermore and Northwest Livermore. So I think there are people who know how that division happens. Cool. And here's the deal. If your group is sort of too big, just break off into two discussion groups. And these are the two questions that we're gonna discuss together. What would it look like for a church to be obsessed with sharing the Father's love? And what would it look like for a church to be obsessed with showing the Father's love? Like, what would this look like lived out in a meaningful way? And then pray for us, pray for each other, that we would be non-hypocritical. Okay, cool. Let's start to go into group areas, and then I'll bring us back together and we will worship together for a few final minutes.